Chapter 13, Clichés and Education. I continued to learn more and more about writing from Dr. Cullis. He taught me so many things in so short a time that I was rather dizzy, like one who suddenly comes upon a treasure chest of jewels and is blinded by their light. In the light of all that I learned from him, I saw the many mistakes I had made. But he was very patient. He came to see me whenever he could make it, sometimes twice and even three times a week. He taught me the technicalities without being technical. He was a good critic and did not let my situation soften his criticism. He believed in me, believed I could become a writer. That gave me the confidence I needed. Soon, I started to write the second version of my autobiography, still by dictation. My scribe now was Francis, my 13-year-old brother, a short-trousered schoolboy, quite different from Eamon because he thought about what he was writing. After we had finished for the day or night, as was often the case, he used to sit down quietly and read over what he had written for me, sometimes asking many questions about the grammar, the construction, the meaning of words and so on, questions which it was hard to answer at times. One night, I asked him what he thought of a chapter we had just finished. He thought for a while, playing with the pen between his fingers, then looked up and said very solemnly, "It's all right, but you need the dictionary beside you when reading it." I wanted to throw the table at him, but he just sat there, not a smile on his face, his hands folded placidly in his lap. I was furious, but I knew there was something in what he said. The second effort at writing the book came out much better than the first. The theme was more clear-cut, the construction more orderly and correlated, and the thought behind it more mature. I hoped for a while that it was good, but still Dr. Cullis shook his head. "Better than before," he said, "but not good enough yet." I pretended to smile, but actually I swore to myself as I contemplated the awful piles of useless manuscript. Would it ever come out right? "Another thing, Christy," he said one night, "you use too many clichés. Do you know what a cliché is?" I didn't. It sounded like some kind of foreign animal or insect, but I found out it was something that everybody said. I found on looking back over my manuscript that Dr. Cullis was right. One December night 2 years ago, Dr. Cullis came into my study and sat down on the seat opposite me. He said nothing for a while, but just sat warming his hands at the fire. Then he pushed his chair away a bit and looked up. "Christy," he said, "I've been thinking about your future. You have talent for original work. The problem is how best to develop it. How far have you got in your education?" "My education? The first and only bit of education I ever had was learning the alphabet from mother at the age of 5. I had gone on from there the best way I could on my own, teaching myself to read books and to learn all I could from them. Education. The very word made me tremble in the middle, for I knew, or rather felt, that I had a long way to go before I started to know what knowledge is." "Not very far," I managed to say. "I see," he said. "Education is invaluable, and in your case, I think it is essential. You couldn't attend a school or university in the ordinary way, so the next best thing is to hire a private tutor for you." A few days later, he came and told me that with the help of Catriona Maguire, he had found the ideal man to teach me. He lived quite close to my own home and was a master in a large school. "I think you'll get on well together," Dr. Cullis said. "He's the sort of tutor any boy would wish to have." The very next morning, a priest of the parish, Father Mullane, came along with my new tutor and introduced me to him. "This is Mr. Guthrie, Christy," said Father Mullane. I looked up and saw before me a short, stocky, fresh-complexioned man of about middle age, with penetrating blue eyes and a humorous mouth. I noticed how deliberate and precise his movements and little gestures were. His whole face seemed lit with a keen intelligence and great compassion. I felt the force and attraction of his personality. I liked him immediately.
"Hello, Christy," he said in a deep, resonant voice, coming forward and shaking hands with me. "I'm delighted to meet you. I hope we'll be partners from now on."
And that was the way of it. Mr. Guthrie began to show his skill at once by breaking down quietly, steadily, and very confidently all the barriers that naturally stood in the way. The relationship that grew between us was friendly, practical, and unassuming. He made me feel as if we were partners in a big and difficult job. He led me forward. He came twice a week, usually on Monday and Wednesday evenings, each session lasting for 2 hours or more. For the first month or so, I felt very backward and uncomfortable in his presence, and I was painfully conscious of the defect in my speech when answering his questions. But after a time, the first bit of awkwardness wore off, and we both became accustomed to each other and settled down to the job in hand. Sometimes, when I sat in my study at home, supposedly reading Shakespeare or working on problems in geometry or arithmetic, I suddenly stopped and started thinking of all the girls I could have met, all the girls I could have danced with and perhaps made love to. I was just 20 years old. I wanted other company besides books. I knew their danger as well as their charm, and I wanted to escape from the danger of constant reading. At these times, I didn't care about being educated or about writing. I wanted to know the joy of climbing a mountain on an early spring morning, or of strolling home in the moonlight along rain-washed city streets with a beautiful girl by my side. I remember one evening when I felt particularly isolated and jealous of my brothers Peter and Paddy, who had gone out with their pals. I was left alone. I was sick of reading. For a time I sat moodily, doing nothing. Francis came in for dictation. He sat down, took out his pen and waited. I knew I had something to say, something to express, but it wouldn't come. I thought and thought, but it was no use. I looked down at my hands, useless as ever. Then suddenly I remembered my left foot. "Get out of here, Francis," I shouted. Poor Francis looked at me as if he was going to cry. "Go on," I said. "Out." He got up and, looking at me over his shoulder like a frightened rabbit, slipped out of the room. Then I threw myself onto my bed, tore off my left shoe and took off my left sock with the other foot. I grabbed a pencil between my first and second toe and began to write. I wrote and wrote without pause. I felt a different person. I wasn't unhappy or frustrated anymore. I was free. I could think. I could live. I could create. Suddenly the door opened and Dr. Collis came in. I stopped and hid my left foot under me. I tried to grin at him and said something about a cold evening. He didn't appear to notice anything, but he sat down by the fire and began to talk about ordinary things. After a while, he came round to the subject of the book. "So you had to start using your left foot again," he said. I pulled it from under me, rather sheepishly. "I wondered," he said, "how long you would last without using it. Dictation is not quite enough, is it? Well, I understand. We won't tell anyone. But don't use it except when you must." I felt released. At peace. At least I could sometimes be myself. And if I couldn't know the joy of dancing, I could know the ecstasy of creating.